We know that the orderly progression of seasons means that this energy is subject to mutation. It is subject to being more or less available. We cannot say that the energy itself is more or less. But we do know that in a given area, at a given time, the energy allotment may be reasonably determined. That this allotment is not continuously identical with itself. That in some areas the allotment is greater than in others. And that this allotment is governed by laws of periodicity. Consequently, we have evidence, physical evidence, to prove that the flowing of this energy into form is subject to laws. That it is not just simply a great sea in which we all swim, but that it is a kind of ocean in which there are innumerable currents. And therefore, that because of the infinite diversity of the sea itself, in this case, it is able to sustain an infinite diversity of life. Studying this, the only answer that anyone has ever been able to advance, and Kepler probably did as well with it as anyone has, the only explanation to account for the control, regulation, systematic distribution of energy is the relationships between universal bodies. That just as surely as the comparatively insignificant inclination of the Earth's axis results in the vast phenomena of season, that actually energy is specialized by relationship. And that it is not that the individual is nearer to it or further from it, but assumes various aspects in relation to it that constitute these modifications. That the continual motion of the heavens, with its innumerable universes and galaxies, extending into the uttermost conceivable and inconceivable fastnesses of duration, that this immense machine actually is responsible for continuous modification in the flow, volume, relationship of energies. Some of these energies moving from remote areas are of such long duration that they are like Plato's Platonic year, which lasts over 25,000 human years. Others of these relationships are so immediate that they are changing every few seconds. There are tremendous interrelationships of long and short time cycles, some extending into such infinities that we can scarcely calculate them. But every one of these cycles is supporting some organized movement in creation. And when these cycles end, these movements end. When these cycles are exhilarated or reach critical areas, critical situations arise, not only affecting man, but affecting the whole solar system and the universe. Thus we live within this tremendous field of energy which is being continuously modified. This modification undoubtedly is responsible for the gradual changes in human psychology. It makes available or less available mental energy, emotional energy. It results in world fatigues and the dying out of races and species. It also results in immediate and momentary fatigues, tensions, stresses, and the various problems with which we are familiar. If, therefore, we are seeking a formula, perhaps one of the simplest understanding formulas that we can have is that man, as a moral, mental, and emotional creature, is constantly interpreting the available conditioned energy upon which he exists. If this energy supply is lessened before it reaches him, we have one kind of phenomenon. If man, through his own development, structural or psychological, becomes resistant or inconsistent with energy which has reached him, therefore does not permit it to move through him in its proper causes and channels, we have another kind of modification. So man is suspended between a moving universe, and all motion results in qualitative modification. Everything that moves changes. And because the universe is infinite motion, infinitely extended, so every moment of the universe is different. Man living within this constant difference experiences one of the first dilemmas, namely that he cannot understand such motion. Therefore, through his ignorance and failure to respond, he does not keep pace with the motion of energy. As the interval between his own motion and that of energy increases, he comes into conflict with the very life principles upon which he depends for existence. Such conflict may well lie beneath the entire problem of human adjustment, physical and metaphysical. Assuming, then, the possibility and the reasonable probability that man is an interpreter of universal energy, that he is a kind of small universe in which all these parts of the greater world have their miniature reflections and models, we then come to the conception that man's existence lies largely upon the foundation of his available energy. Energy is the source of function, and function for man is the reason for existence. Unless he is able to function in these patterns, he has lost the significance of these patterns to himself. If then we must seek for a basic explanation, let us remember that the very primary element of ancient astrological thinking had to do with energy allotments. We divide people today into two basic types: those who are truly active and those who are tired. And today, the majority of human beings is tired. This tremendous sense of fatigue, which we all commonly experience, and which makes life increasingly difficult for us. The ancients recognized this and declared that it was due to certain negative cycles, or cycles of negativity, moving in the great tidal system of space, that as the tides of the sea ebb and flow, so the tides of energy in man ebb and flow. Now, ebbing and flowing psychologically is a very important thing, inasmuch as we have to recognize that energy is never actually absent. It is merely not available in its accustomed form and demands a new or different kind of adjustment. This adjustment we have in psychological thinking in two types of persons, called the extrovert and the introvert. The extrovert is the individual who seemingly possesses more abundant immediate energies. The introvert is the individual in whose life these objective energies are not as obvious or abundant. Nature is only telling us, however, that in the character of man, as in the universe or in the growth of the oak tree, there are alternations of objectivity and subjectivity required in nature. In an effort to standardize living, we have totally ignored this. We have assumed that every individual, at all times, must be upon an equal energy footing. It is possible that he is upon an equal footing, but he is not able to exhibit or manifest identical, equal energy at all times. We know that sleep is intended to help us to catch up on some of our energy problems, but it does not go as far as our providing needs at the moment. Sleep may take care of part of our physical and psychological life, but there is something else that has to be considered, namely that nature has set this grand pattern that is caused to operate by an innumerable galaxy of suns, and that man, regardless of his egoism, is still merely a tiny creature within this incredible machinery. Man's happy adjustment depends upon his gradual understanding of the kind of world he lives in and his willingness to live according to what he understands when he does learn. This combination is essential to his life. Introversion and extroversion are natural motions. They are the result of the fact that nature recognizes that man has two needs. He has need for an external life, and he has need for an internal life. Experience shows that unbalance, the overdevelopment of his external life, has impoverished his internal life. By his failure to enrich it with the conscious contributions of his own mental and emotional energies. As a result of his own failure, man therefore has come to the point where extroversion or self-expression outwardly becomes comparatively easy for him, and he is inclined to overdo it. Whereas introversion, or the return of the individual inward, the turning of his tides towards his internal life, has resulted in him coming face to face with a situation so deplorable that under general conditions, introversion has become practically synonymous with neurosis. Thus, instead of living a balanced life of internal and external polarizations, the individual is so depleted, impoverished, or neglected inwardly that he is like too many persons in our nation who drive a fine car and give all the sense of prosperity, but whose homes are neglected and chaotic. The individual, turning into himself, finds a condition which leads to suffering rather than adjustment. This is nature pointing out a defect, for man should be able to move inwardly and outwardly without tension or stress, finding an excellent, important, and useful life in both of these polarizations. If his energies were available to him, such would be possible. Now, other factors also contribute to man's life, and there can be no doubt whatever that time and place do influence the entrance of the human being into material life. The time and condition in which a person is born is valuable. The important thing has been ignored psychologically, although it is accepted historically. Can we deny that an individual born at the beginning of the Napoleonic Wars was under a different type of environmental heritage than the person that was born, we will say, in the Golden Age of Greece? Now, both may have had their wars and their troubles, but it is not possible to say that the time and place of birth are meaningless. The time the individual is born and the place where he is born, these circumstances bring him into a particular relationship with the patterns of history, and also with the relations and customs and attitudes of tribes and nations, racial groups, and social structures. Man being born today is born into a social pattern that did not exist 100 years ago. We know that in living, the average person cannot psychologically outlive his generation. If he is forced into conflict with his own upbringing, and the years of experience through which he has passed, he becomes discouraged and confused. Psychology makes a great deal of heredity. Astrology simply states that man's universal heredity is derived from his relationship to universal energy fields. Also, that the peculiar circumstance of his birth is a relationship between energy in the field of space and the energy of the individual himself. Therefore, there is a time to be born and a time to die. And these things are within chemical fields of relationships, which are exact and inevitable in nature. By means of such laws and principles, not only is universal machinery maintained, but also universal ethics. The rightness of things is made possible because of the immutability of the universal pattern in which we exist. Also, in studying their nativities of persons in ancient times, the old stargazers studied, first of all, the individual's personality. The personality is that part of us which we exhibit to others. This personality is the container, the vessel, into which energies will be poured. It also reveals the immediate use that we shall make of the energy available to us, a use which will be in some way unique or different from the use made by another person. Consequently, personality becomes the final distributor of man's personal energy. It tells us about his enthusiasms, his interests, and his attitudes. It gives us something of the degree of specialization in which his life will be patterned. Then this is compared with another very great factor, and that is his energy allotment. And basically, this allotment was anciently based upon the position of the sun in the relationship of the great year. Thus, as truly we have distribution of available energy in the seasons, persons born in these seasons have certain energy peculiarities. And not long ago, there was a published list of accidents on the Bay Bridges in San Francisco. And it was pointed out that the accident rate is entirely erratic and breaks all laws of accidental probabilities. Instead of these accidents occurring according to a patternless sequence, these accidents are highly patterned, and by the study of them, it becomes immediately obvious that the accident is not an accident, that it is based upon certain energy problems, that the individual at the wheel is much more likely to go to sleep and have an accident, or is much more likely to have slow reflexes and have an accident. All these things are determined, apparently, by energy allotments. Thus, the sun, to the ancient, was the symbol of man's energy allotment, its relationship to him, its effect upon him, and the bridge between the sun in the heaven and the source of life light in man. This bridge was always regarded as the nativity, the symbol, the horoscope, the sign by means of which certain actual calculations of the availability of energy resources could be made. Now, better calculations may be made in the future, but we view with considerable interest the audacity of the ancient, who long before the dawn of science actually did fashion the bridge, by means of which he sought to measure the life power in man and the peculiar action of this life power in various men, not merely in an empiric situation. from energy allotment, then, we come to the conclusion that two kinds of persons do exist. Those who by nature are essentially positive, and those by nature essentially negative. Now, by negative and positive, we do not mean good and bad, nor do we mean strong and weak, nor do we mean helpful and helpless. These are not the applications, because as the Chinese and East Indians pointed out long ago, the greatest mystery of all is the mystery of negative energy, not positive energy. Now, up to the present moment, we have considered negative energy merely that part of energy which we do not understand. Negative energy may also be that part to which we do not immediately respond. It may also be that part of energy not yet explored. And if that is what is meant, then indeed the negative energy is the greater part, because we know hardly a fraction of what must ultimately be known about these subjects. But negative energy is in some way what we might term a spiritual energy. It is negative as we now view all spiritual things, because they are not immediately visible to us. It is negative because it does not help us to get rich. That is, not obviously. And anything that does not help pay bills is not only negative, it is a luxury in these times. It is termed negative also because it forces man into one of the most disagreeable relationships he can endure, and that is into his own company. Negative energy is energy which has by its tendency a motion inward or away from objectivity. Negative energy, therefore, to us may be little more than a vacuum. But it is this vacuum that it conceals the mystery of deity. All things moving upon the levels of positive energy are very obvious in their functions. The individual gets up, rolls up his sleeves, and does things. But what does he do? What is the final result of what he does? Usually his own destruction. By positive energy, he is led from one excess of action to another. Also, of course, he is led to a certain degree of material accomplishment. It is not that we should discount so-called objective energy. It is that we should recognize that, like nearly everything else that makes up our modern pattern, it is of secondary importance elevated to first place. That this so-called positive energy is leading us into a quantitative victory over the unknown, whereas what is termed negative energy is the secret of our qualitative victory. And of this, we have very little knowledge or thought at the present time. Nearly all solutions to all problems arise from the individual who is able to become adjusted receptively to truth. Receptive adjustment, therefore, makes use of a kind of energy which is different from that which is used in material objective adjustment. Actually, receptivity appears to use less energy. Actually, it uses more of a very refined kind of energy, because receptivity is not negativity as we know it. What we call negative energy is simply an energy with a purpose which does not lie within the field of our ordinary experience. Yet upon this energy, we must build, and we live because of it. Because our internal life is sustained by this energy in the same way that our external life is sustained by material energy. Out of the study of the effects of the universe upon man, we must ultimately come to the recognition that man has an internal life which we may term a psychological life, and that this is subjected to laws other than the laws of matter. Our attitude today is that all influence that models or molds the internal life of man comes from the outside and is made aware, and we are made aware of it, or it is visible to us because of the light of the sun shining upon it. Paracelsus declared emphatically that the interior life of man is also subject to energies and laws which are not obvious materially, and that the individual's inner life is subject to its own environment, the forces of it, and the energies sustaining it. If our outside life is in a quantitative environment, our inner life is in a qualitative environment. Consequently, our inner life has an existence of its own. And this existence also has a nativity, has an endurance in space, and is subject to a kind of energy pattern. What we call psychologically archetypes are more or less proofs of this. For archetypes are forms set up in a formless state. They are kinds of entities which are not materially available to us, yet they become the actual motivating symbolic energy powers by which conduct can be and is modified. Thus, in astrology, the ancients were firmly convinced that man possessed an internal being, and that this internal being was subject to laws that must be discovered, and that these laws are not just the laws of material existence, but are laws relating to the control direction of electrical and magnetic phenomena. That the spiritual life of man operates in a field of energy, just exactly as the material life of man operates in a field of phenomena. That we must understand this energy, and must most of all adjust to it. The inner life of man has a normal or an abnormal adjustment with its own energy fields. When the inner life of man is completely the result of the pressure from the lower outer life of man, then this inner life is imprisoned, locked within a situation for which it was not intended. There was never a time in nature when nature intended the lesser to govern the greater. There was never a time in the constitution of man when it was assumed that the outer life of man could satisfactorily regulate his inner life. In every instance, the inner life must regulate the outer. Authority must be vested in that which is superior. When, therefore, the outer life of man, affecting the internal life, makes it difficult or impossible for the psychic field to operate normally in manifestation in this world, we have a psychotic. We have a false situation whenever we try to force that which is less upon that which is intrinsically more. Also in this situation, we have the continual fact of the need for the psychic life of man to keep the laws of the psychic life of the universe. Man who breaks the material laws of nature is punished physically. When man's entity or selfhood comes out of adjustment with universal energy, he is punished inwardly or metaphysically. He is punished by a series of invisible ailments that are as dangerous to him as physical ailments are to the body. Paracelsus pointed out that every ailment known to the body has its equivalent in the psychic field of man, and that it is just as easy for the individual to be sick psychically as it is physically. But he did not affirm, and neither did the other ancients, that all psychic sickness arises from the personality. He assumed that psychic sickness arises from psychic disobedience, in the same way that physical sickness results from physical disobedience. And psychic disobedience is in harmony between the energy field of man and the great universal field which must nourish it. In harmony of this kind, man does arise from several possible causes. The most common cause would be paralleling that of physical ailments. Namely, that the individual's psychic field is unable to form a natural, proper adjustment with its own source of nutrition. That wherever this occurs, you have psychic stress. And wherever this occurs, you have something else that causes it. And the thing that causes it would be the equivalent of egoism or egotism. The individual who stands against the law, the individual who believes or thinks that he does not have to obey, the individual who takes an attitude of aggressive egoism in forcing his own concepts upon nature, his punishment for his arrogance is exactly what occurred to the builders of the Tower of Babel. As most ancient physicians and some schools of modern medicine point out, the greatest single cause of sickness is obstruction, that by means of which natural function is impaired. Bodily obstruction due to tension will impair body function and reduce health. Psychic tension in the form of psychic stress interferes with the distribution of energy on the psychic plane and makes possible the development of psychic ailments. If then the problem of the great cyclic year is taken into consideration, man must not only keep the laws of nature to exist, but he must also keep the laws of soul if he is going to exist. The laws of nature, these are simply man's way of naming energies. Laws are actually at least manifested through great orderly energy patterns. Wherever there is disobedience, it means that we have broken relationship with energy. Wherever we have gone our own way, regardless of right and wrong, we have broken harmonious relations with energies that were necessary to sustain us. And the ill result of our poor conduct is due to the amount of energy that is cut off. In the same manner, our psychic life is due to the energies which by various attitudes, complexes, fixations, etc., by which we crystallize or obstruct the motion of the psychic life of man. It is as though a fish in the sea tried to stand firm and prevent the tides, especially a very small fish, a minnow. This particular type of disobedience is ridiculous and is only possible because man does not understand. If he ever saw the facts, he would not be so foolish. Actually, however, adjustment with nature carries much more of an implication than we generally assume. Let us imagine that man psychically formed an adjustment with the great energy fields by which he lives. His adjustment must be almost a Buddhistic one. And perhaps this is one of the reasons why Buddhism will someday be of the greatest value in psychology. Man adjusting to universal energies, psychically particularly, where you have a much more volatile world of value, he is adjusting to motion. He is not adjusting to something that is fixed. He is not adjusting to a point where he has once adjusted, it will always be so. He is adjusting to something that is never twice the same. He is adjusting to something that is itself pure motion. Consequently, his adjustment cannot be a mental one. because the mind's thoughts cannot move that rapidly. It cannot be an emotional one, because his emotional climate cannot change so quickly. His adjustment must be one, then, of total acceptance of motion. Or everything which impedes motion or impairs it must cease in his own psychic field. And unless it does, he will continuously be subject to pressure. Now, such an adjustment is not negation. It is the most difficult of all possible attainments, because it means that the individual must be integrated in constant motion. He cannot merely lie back and float. He must function in motion. He must recognize that out of a moving core within himself, continually adjusting more completely to the energy patterns of space, he is unfolding, he is growing, he is moving with qualitative as well as quantitative motion. To achieve this is a very high end in learning and knowledge. And before he can achieve it, he must recognize the need of it. He must recognize, therefore, that the universe is constantly impelling him to subjective adjustment, is penalizing him for having a certain crystallization within his psychic life, by means of which his physical life is damaged and the unfoldment of his internal life is frustrated. To move with these energies, to be able to use them, requires a greater knowledge of them and their attributes, their qualities, and their keywords. And the ancient fashioned a simple little design on a piece of paper, which he called a horoscope, and in which he set forth in an elementary and rudimentary manner, it is true, the pattern of man's most immediate adjustment situation. He was convinced in his old days that this pattern was valid, that it was the only form of learning known to man in which his personal relationship with the universe was revealed, that it was no longer a grand relationship, but an intimate one in which the universe moving into man and through man, and man moving into the universe and through the universe, that these twofold procedures could be analyzed, classified, studied, and with sufficient pains and effort, the entire subject could be broken open and made available to the individual. On this line of thinking, then, I believe there is more work to be done. More work that should be done as soon as possible in order that we can finally get at the subjective person, not merely as he is reflected through body, but as he exists in his own nature, and will begin to emphasize the importance of working directly upon this subjective being by the great disciplines of philosophy and religion, rather than to depend entirely upon reflex action from the external life. We are working in a clumsy manner. We are trying. We are much further than we were 50 years ago. But we still have a long way to go. And it would be nice to feel that everyone essentially interested will do all they can to encourage this research and not fall into the ancient pattern of pronouncing these things impossible or improbable. We live in a world where nothing is impossible. And the great thing that must be made possible is human adjustment. And until that is achieved, there will be no solution to the common disasters under which we must mutually suffer. It is our own final adjustment with this great clock of space, with its countless intermingling values, that gives us our hope of ultimate security and peace. Time's up. Now, not long ago, we had a number of folks came together and were talking about something. And someone said, yes, reincarnation is a very interesting theory. Karma is fascinating. But what would it do to our Western way of life? Supposing everyone started believing it here, living according to it, would it mean that we would have economic failures? Would it mean bankruptcy? Would the bottom drop out of the stock exchange? What would happen to our religions, our philosophies, and our sciences? If we lived and believed according to this doctrine, would we go forward 1,000 years or backward 1,000 years? It's an interesting theory and problem, so we're going to discuss it next week. We hope you'll all be here to share in this occasion. We have a little pamphlet called Planetary Influences and the Human Soul, which may be of interest in connection with the subject of this morning. We also have a book dealing with the primitive concepts of the principles underlying the study of astrology from a philosophic rather than a genolithiacal level. The subject is a philosophy of astrology. Don't forget our newest book, Collected Writings, which might make a nice Christmas present if you know friends who like our books and do not have this one. Our Lady of Dreams book has been used by hundreds and thousands of people for Christmas gifts. So we call this one to your attention as something that might help you where something a little better than a card is required. Our used book table has a number of gems on it, which we think you will enjoy browsing through. And we certainly thank you for being with us this week and hope to see you next week.